Hello, and welcome to not High and Low. Christ, what is this? We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. This is a special episode we teased maybe in July, I think. July or June, where randomly, Joel, you messaged me. Why not do a Jackie Brown episode?
Yeah, I thought it would be interesting having done some of the work that we've done. Although, you know, we haven't strayed that much into any sort of black exploitation, with the exception of, like, I don't even think Cotton comes to Harlem falls under that necessarily. But, well, anyways, once upon a time in Hollywood, how do you do an ellipses? We decided it would be good to match Jackie Brown in that area.
Yeah, and I thought of the right person, because I on Twitter I see this guy talk about Once Upon a Time and Tarantino stuff, Travis Woods.
Hey, hello, how are you guys?
Hi, Travis. I can't help but notice that you have several Quentin Tarantino posters there. Would you say you're a fan?
Yeah, I spend way too much money on Mondo posters.
Oh, yeah, understandable.
Including their Tyler Stout Tarantino series. And yes, I'm a very big fan. I love Tarantino's movies.
Okay. So, how did... I presume you're older than me. How did you first hear Tarantino? Like, what was your first one?
I'm vaguely 30-something. We'll say that. My first experience with Tarantino, I worked at a video store in high school in the late 90s, and just started digging into his work. My first film of his was Reservoir Dogs, which I thought, like everybody else, I thought was amazing. It's a heist film that doesn't show the heist. And then, like, you know, that was my gateway drug, and went right from that to Pulp. And Jackie Brown was the first Tarantino film that I saw when it came out as a fan. And like a lot of fans, it really threw me at first. Of course, I was like 15 years old, so I was an idiot. And so I think I was expecting Pulp Fiction 2, like a lot of people, when it came out. And because it wasn't that, I really didn't know how to process it. And it took me a couple of years and some growing up before I understood it to be the quiet jewel and masterpiece that I think it is.
Okay. Joel, you're, as I've said in other episodes, you're 10 years and one day older than me. How did you first hear about Mr. QT?
I remember in high school somebody had a copy of Pulp Fiction, but in high school I was not a movie watcher, and I think I was slightly afraid of any R-rated movie. I was not the bravest kid in high school. No, we just didn't have R-rated movies in my house. So let's see. I think Pulp Fiction must have been the first one I saw, and then when I was just going through, I was like, oh, let's see what other stuff he had. So I saw Reservoir Dogs and then Jackie Brown, and I think, Jackie Brown clicked with me more than the other two did. Like, obviously, I really liked them both, but I think because I read Elmore Leonard's style books, that I was just, like, really into the story, and this is a kind of a heist movie that has a heist, speaking of that thing there. So that's also something I dig.
Yeah. I remember, I think I first heard Tarantino on The Simpsons with Itchy and Scratchy. They're like a random segment where like Tarantino like pops up out of nowhere and he has like a cereal box or something. It's like during a good era of The Simpsons. And being like eight, I was like, who is this guy with a weird voice and weird face? And then a couple years later, I saw Pulp Fiction on AMC on a double feature with Fargo. So pretty quickly I was introduced to like a whole new world of films, and I became Tarantino crazy for like the next 5 years. And I think the first one I like saw in the theater was Inglourious. And Jackie Brown was the one that took me the longest to find, because where I live, like the DVD wasn't available yet, but special edition one, and it never showed on TV. And so, but once I like saw it, it became my favorite one. And I kind of stopped watching Tarantino like for like a few years, just kind of. Not like protest or anything. It just kind of stopped, and I still kept the DVDs. I just haven't really come back to them until a couple days ago.
Heartbreak.
So have you been doing a big rewatch?
I saw Once Upon a Time, which is the first time I've seen a Tarantino movie, a new one, where it didn't really work for me.
Oh no!
And I'm not really sure why. I don't think it's bad. Just like,
yeah, let's get into Jackie Brown then, if we're gonna talk about things that may or may not have worked for Spencer.
Like, Jackie Brown used to be one of my favorite movies, but then I didn't watch it for like 6 years, so.
And now I don't know. It's less so, huh?
Yeah, I'm not really sure why. I think maybe this, like, short answer, it's a heist movie, and I knew every single beat extremely well, because it was like the 7th or 8th time I've seen it,
right?
And like, I have it like firmly planted in my brain. Like, I remember like every single shot and like and almost all of every line of dialogue.
So like, you say like some of the polish has gone off of the Jewel, you know? It's just, yeah, it's a little bit dull, because I feel like that's what's happened to me with Inglourious Basterds, because that's one I've seen like 6 or 7 times, and now, you know, I was really crazy into it, and now it's like, I don't, you know, I can still, having viewed it enough times, it's kind of like, well, yeah, I've got this beat and got that beat.
It's interesting that you say that, though, about Jackie. I mean, I could probably just go to it for maybe different things. As you say, you see it as a heist movie, and from a plot perspective, because you know all the ins and outs, it can drag on. But for me, the reason I think it's such a strong film that I can always return to is I view it less as a heist film and more as, you know, it's a hangout movie. It's like a Howard, yeah, it's like a Howard Hawks film. And it's more about, it's that dazed and confused thing, to a degree, or like Rio Bravo, where when you rewatch the movie, or when I rewatch the movie, it's more to hang out with these characters again. And, you know,
although there's no music breaks like in Rio Bravo.
That's true. That's true. Although there's some great music.
Yeah.
But I love just, I love just kicking back and having a drink with Wardell, which I wouldn't want to do in real life, but I'm fine to do across the screen. But yeah, I love just revisiting these characters and this world, especially because as much as I love some of Tarantino's more quote-unquote cinematic movie, as he calls them, universes, I really love the kind of, well, this movie's like a well-worn pair of shoes. It's not over the top, and it's not super splashy. It's not, there's not a comic book element to it the way, like, say, Kill Bill has. Yeah. And there's just something very, like I said, it's like a comfortable pair of old shoes that you can just slip back into. And I love just being able to slip back into this world. And the plot mechanics and the this and the that of it aren't nearly as important to me as just being able to hang out with Jackie and Wardell and Lewis and listen to them talk and watch them watch old movies.
Yeah, like this time I really paid more attention to like the getting older part, and I really noticed like how all the main characters, De Niro is like a middle-aged guy who's been in prison for a little bit and is out of touch with the current world, and they talk about how Sam Jackson's Ordell is kind of had to move to guns because drugs wasn't working, so he's kind of out of element, and just like this whole everyone is kind of out of element in middle age and just trying to, except for Bridget Fonda, who I guess went from being like a hot young 20-year-old to now she's 30 or whatever, and so she's not as hot as she used to be, which I guess like is her thing. But
yeah, and it's, and you know, I love that it's set in the South Bay, and not Los Angeles proper, even though it's always kind of grouped as a as an LA proper film. I love that it's set in the South Bay because this is a movie about people for whom life has kind of passed them by, and the fact that they are all grouped together, but they're also, you know, they're not living as opposed to say Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. They're not living in the city where dreams come true. They're living on the outskirts of that city. It's almost like they're on the outside looking in, and they're all chasing these various dreams.
I wouldn't have gotten that because I've never been to California. It's like I assume that's just like is L.A. Like to me, L.A. is just like New York, which I know is a stupid thing to say, but I've never been to L.A. So I don't like know what it like looks like or feels like. It's personally.
Mostly in like the Del Amo Fashion Center that was it's Torrance. So it's like a solid hour from Los Angeles. And so yeah, when I view it as these characters who, you know, they don't even have access to. It's a cheesy phrase, but they don't even have access to the city of dreams, the city where dreams come true. They're all on the outside, looking in, just the way you know Jackie, how she works as a flight attendant on God, what do you call it? The shittiest little shitty fucking piece of shit Mexican airline there is. You know, she works at LAX in this transitory place, getting to watch all of these people fly to their vacation destinations, or people coming to LA for their vacation. But for her, it's just a job. She doesn't get to partake in that. And, you know, I feel like that's a really kind of melancholic, surprisingly melancholic thread that winds its way through the film that I don't think anyone really expected when it first came out, and I think it's one of the reasons why the reaction to it was fairly muted amongst the hardcore Tarantino fans. I think a lot, like I said, a lot of people, including the idiot 15-year-old me, went into this movie expecting a Pulp Fiction sequel, and instead got this very kind of quiet, darkly ruminative meditation on whether or not you've peaked, and if the good times are all behind you. And that's I'm just gonna keep going since no one's gonna shut me up, and I'm gonna go even further.
Joel, you have anything to say?
Someone better stop me, because I'm gonna keep going. But that said, I will say this: before Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out, everyone called Jackie Brown Tarantino's midlife crisis movie. And even though that's what his characters are going through, they're all going through some sort of crises. I never looked at this as his midlife crisis movie. I looked at it as, you know, for me, Jackie Brown is a movie about Tarantino and where he was at the dawn of his 30s. Because if you think about it, this guy was 31 when he co-wrote and directed the film that everyone declared had changed cinema. He was 30. Pulp Fiction came out when he was 31.
He won Cannes.
Yeah, he won the Palme d'Or for his second film. And everyone is saying, you've changed cinema, you've revolutionized cinema, and to a degree, he really did dictate the next decade of filmmaking. And, you know, everyone was saying, you're the new Godard, you've created the high watermark for film in the last decade of this century. And think about it, if you are 31 years old and you are hearing that over and over and over again, by the time you turn 32, or 33, and you're looking at the blank page of what your next project is going to be, I don't know about you guys, maybe you're far more well-adjusted than I am, but if I were in those shoes, And everyone had spent the last 2 years telling me that I had reinvented cinema and that I was a genius and, oh my God, we can't wait to see what you do next. I would be paralyzed by thoughts of, did I peak? Have I already done the best that I am ever going to do? Will I ever be able to be better than I was? Or was that it? And everything that comes after that is just going to be a slow and steady decline. And what I think is fascinating is I can't imagine a universe in which that didn't occur to him after Pulp Fiction. And what I think he did was really smartly realize that the other time in life where you might be thinking those thoughts would be in midlife. And so he kind of married, in my opinion, what he must have been going through post-Pulp Fiction to this Elmore Leonard story about men and women who are getting closer and closer to the wrong side of 50 and asking themselves the very same question that would come at that time. That question of, have I done as good as I'm ever going to do? Have I peaked? And so in a way, I feel like, despite the fact that it's adapted material, I feel like in a way Jackie Brown has to be one of his most personal films, because I feel like it's so reflective of that post-Pulp Fiction period for him. And that's my rant.
Oh, all right. Joel, you got anything?
Why do you keep, like, what am I doing? What?
I don't know. You have any thoughts?
On what? On life?
Yeah. I mean, you're older than me. Like, you're approaching Jackie's age in the movie.
Yeah, like 50.
No, you're 10 years and one day older than me.
56.
Yes.
So you want me to, you have a question or?
Oh, you like this movie a lot too.
I certainly do like this movie a lot, because it's a bunch of old people. No, that's not that's incorrect. Obviously, as you said, I'm not that far off. But the fact that Robert Forrester and
Pam Grier,
sorry, are the star, basically the romantic leads of the movie, is kind of mind blowing. Especially because it works. I feel like that little romance thing that it seems like Fred is a little bit more into than Pam.
Fred?
Why was I saying...
Robert.
Max Cherry.
Robert?
Thank you,
Robert. Max. Okay.
Why was I thinking Fred? That's weird.
You know what Fred Williams said? What are you talking about?
No, there's an actor I mix him up with, and now I can't... Anyway. Anyways.
Is it the Coen Brothers guy? Never mind.
We're not talking about Fargo here.
I know.
Anyways, their little romance, it feels weirdly... I mean, it's nice. It's not creepy or anything like that. It doesn't seem unrealistic, you know. And just the way Max Cherry has a crush on her. And these, like I said, these are older people. It seems weird that it works so well. And I don't know if it's Tarantino's dialogue that makes it seem that way. I mean, it's certainly the actors. They've got the chops, and neither of them really took off after this movie because the way it was received, but...
Yeah. Well, hey, Pam was in Ghosts of Mars.
Yes.
And
Escape from Los Angeles.
Other stuff. Yeah, Pam should have had a bigger comeback, but she is a middle-aged black woman who wasn't Angela Bassett, so
yeah,
Hollywood has room for one, and it was Angela Bassett.
Yeah, the only one whose career took off was Samuel L. Jackson. No, that's not true.
Yeah, well, Spike made his career.
Yeah.
Okay. It was also, how wild was it that the thing that it was obviously the right choice when you watch the film, but how wild was it that Tarantino used his post Pulp Fiction cachet to cast Robert Forster and Pam Grier as the leads in his film? Like, he's in that position where he can do whatever he wants. He's had the biggest hit, one of the biggest hits of the decade. He can do anything he wants. And he's like, I want to get the guy from, Alligator, and I want the star of Coffee and Foxy Brown. That's who I want to be my. Those are my leads, you know. Which on paper, I'm sure, you know, everyone at Miramax was terrified. This is like the most unsexy coupling I'm sure they could think of, and yet, you know, I love the balls on Tarantino. Those are his leads for the film that follows the biggest hit. Of his life to that point is Robert Forster, Pam Grier. And it is, and it is great. It really works, and I do love the sweetness too of Max Cherry. Yeah. One of my favorite scenes is just, it's fucking adorable when he goes to buy a cassette tape of the Delphonics because that's what she plays in her apartment, and he just wants to feel closer to her. I love him driving around the South Bay listening to her music, just thinking about her.
Yeah, it's, I'm gonna say something about Robert Forster, but I like that they're both damaged people that are like both fully willing to like kill or hurt someone for something, because like obviously the movie ends with Jackie like, you know, getting Ordell killed, and just a vague sense of maybe she did do some crimes and like hurt people potentially. And Max Cherry, you know, like he's very nonchalant about like, well, I broke into this guy's house. I had a stun gun. I had my gun ready for just in case. And, like, yet there's this sweetness and humanity to them where a lesser screenplay would, I think, harp on that a little too much. And this is focused on their humanity. And, like, yeah, there's people who want to find love and they're lonely. And they're in, you know, as you said, the city of dreams. But, you know, they're trying to figure out if they can still find their dreams. In like the end, every time devastates me when she leaves and Max just walks to the back of his office, and like I always see it as he realizes he made a mistake by not going with her.
Yeah, but he can't go with her either. I think and the script makes it a little bit more clear in that there's a brief flash cut to the moment, we're going all over the place here in the movie, but there's in the script there's a brief flashback to Pam in his office Jackie in Max Cherry's office yelling he's got a gun before she even sees if Ordell has a gun, which is what gets him killed. And in the moment after she kisses him, Max Cherry flashes to that, and that's why he doesn't go with her. And the implication being, he's not entirely sure that she didn't use him. And there's something about the almost, I won't call it cold-blooded, but there's something about the Machiavellian nature of Jackie's plotting that frightens him a little bit.
Yeah, and it's kind of Shakespearean, almost.
Yeah, it's just enough to make him hesitate when she leaves. And hesitate long enough for her just to let her leave. And then, yeah, I agree that it's almost like it's only after she's gone does he realize, you know, I could have had something here. We could have had something. I could have made this work.
Yeah. Although she does say she will send postcards and stuff. So there is potential of, you know, maybe in the future, maybe like I haven't read Rum Punch. I bought it to give to my mom as a present because she loves this movie, but she still hasn't read after like 5 years, but that's another story. But like I'm wondering if Elmore Leonard, I should research this beforehand, did any sequels, because I feel like, because I know Ordell does appear in other books.
Lewis and Ordell both, there's a book before this where they're in Detroit and Melanie as well, and They try to pull off a kidnapping scheme where they kidnap the wife of a rich man and hold her hostage, only to find out that the rich man is looking to divorce her anyway and doesn't want to pay the ransom for her.
Ah.
And I believe that was also adapted into a film starring.
Is that the George Clooney one?
No. That's Out of Sight, which also shares a character with this film,
which is Michael Keaton.
Yeah. But yeah, there was a previous book in which we see Ordell and Lewis in their younger years, along with Melanie. Oh. And this is the counterpoint to that. And now that they're all kind of slowing down, and they've lost a little bit too much time and too much money, and they're all kind of hustling for one last score.
Yeah, I find, Travis, this isn't a spoiler, but you're a white man, and the hair in this movie on Pam and Jackson, like, it seems to be because Pam's hair is straightened and not natural, and Sam has a wig that's this like long straight hair. It's like that's like, you know, clearly flattened, and just I see that as like them not truly like, whenever I see like not natural hair on black characters in like a movie wherever, I always perceive it as they aren't being true to themselves. And like I see like Pam, this like she has the straightened, more treated hair as like a symbol of like that's what's her adjusting to the world that she kind of got sucked into.
Spencer, where, I need you to watch this movie called School Days, where yes. It shows that, you know, both sides are yes. correct when it comes to hair.
Well, yeah, but when you say like Coffee and Foxy Brown, she has natural hair, and here is like this interesting like a development of like you could say that this is a continuation of Foxy Brown or Coffee, like this when she's older and like she's adjusted and to like a more normal like a world where she kind of
gain life almost.
Yeah. And she like sacrificed like the natural hair, and Ordell, his hair is like trying to like it makes him look more villainous.
Yeah.
In cartoony, in that fucking soul patch that's braided, and it's like, yep. And it's a little soul patch, and that's just like
that's the most upsetting.
Okay, yeah, I'm gonna say the same thing.
You know, I always took it his bizarre hairstyle in this movie. You know, he's got like you said that rust orange hair that's just like cabled into this garish ponytail, and then with a matching with that matching soul patch that goes down to like his Adam's apple. I you know, I viewed that almost the same way I viewed that root, those like that really bright like screwdriver yellow jacket that he wears that kind of hide that he's got, you know, some burgeoning love handles on either side of this little paunch that he's starting. I viewed, if you look, he's got a bit of a receding hairline. And yeah. There's a couple of shots where you can see that he's got a growing bald spot. And in a film that is so focused on tracking, you know, the damage that time can do, I always look at Ordell as a guy who dresses this way and styles his hair this way because he's not just dressed for success, but he's trying to deny, disguise, and distract in any way he can from the fact that time is changing. And he's kind of doing the Michael Bolton 90s thing, where if he could just keep his hair as long as possible, you're going to miss that he's losing it elsewhere. And like, I feel like
Brett Michaels with the headband of the handkerchief thing.
I don't know what you're talking about. That's his hair.
No, he's been going bald for a while. He does like ties the thing on his head to hide it.
Jeez, I didn't know you were his barber. No.
I think the Hulkster does it too. Noted racist Hulk Hogan.
He doesn't have to do that. He's always had a freaking dome up there.
Mary just came in and gave me a shameful look that I mentioned the Hulkster.
You should be mad. She should.
Okay.
But I would agree that Ordell's hair is maybe the most disturbing thing in the film. But I think it's disturbing with a purpose. I think it's a smart bit of character design, just like his clothing. This is a guy that's a gun runner who should be trying to lay low, who's got to assume that the DEA has eyes on him, and yet he's always dressing in fluorescent clothing, like it's, you know, 1989, and he, you know, it is electric red pants and, you know, yellow shirts and yellow jackets. And but I do think in his mind it serves a purpose, which is he's distracting you from the fact that he's no longer a young man.
Like, Sam Jackson has that quality of you're not sure how old he actually is. Because, like, even with, like, the Spike Lee stuff he's in, and I think School Days is the first one he's in, he looked like he could be 45 or 55, but then you look at, like, Pulp Fiction, and like, you look like he could be, like, maybe 35, and then you look at this, and it's like, oh, he could be, like, 60 years old, and, like he has this ageless quality to
him.
He really does. And, well, until recently. Well, now he kind of is starting to age a little bit.
It had to happen eventually. You know, just waited until he was, what, 90? He's
old. But yeah, like, in Pulp Fiction, he looks like he's 32, and in this film, he looks like he's at least 55.
Yeah, and, you know, and Pam aged like fine wine. She looks the same here as she did 20 years before this.
Well, her ass got fat. That's what she says.
Yeah, I mean...
And then Max Cherry has the cutest response in the world. There's something so adorable about that. How cool he's trying to be. He's like, ain't nothing wrong with that. I love Max.
Did you see the other version of this scene that's on the Blu-ray? He says exactly the same thing. You know, ain't nothing wrong with that. Followed immediately by, how about you sit on my face later? Wait, what? Okay, never mind. So, this podcast went blue and it's my fault.
Oh my God.
Hey, Spencer, what's going on? I want to get into, if we can, the influences. Like, I feel like there must be some direct, you know, like, references to blaxploitation stuff or anything like that that I'm just not that familiar with. I mean, do you have any idea?
I would think, like, Coffee/Foxy Brown, because Pam Grier and those are most iconic roles. And Sid Haig is in the movie, and he's in a bunch of stuff with her.
Yeah.
And I need to... this is very important. Sid Haig, as of a couple hours ago, I learned is in ICU after an accident.
Yeah.
He's 80 years old. And I haven't really talked about this on any podcast ever, but he is genuinely one of my favorite actors. He was, like, one of my first favorite actors where I had to see, like, everything I could possibly find with him in it. Including, like, this really terrible Night of Living Dead remake from, like, 2003. But, like, my night went from excited to despair once I learned that he might die. So, that's what people know, Sid Haig. You know, keep him in your thoughts, pray for him, whatever you do.
Let's all have a drink for Sid right now.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, Sid is, having Sid Haig in it. Sid Haig in the movie too, because he was in Coffee, Foxy Brown. He's in her Filipino movies that she did for Corman. Like he's all over. So like that's another like direct reference.
Speaking of which, there's a great, great, great Pam Grier song from the 1970s. I think it's from 71. It's called "Long Time Woman" that she recorded for The Big Dollhouse, which was her first Women in Prison movie that she did with Jack Hill in the Philippines. And that film, or excuse me, that song is on the Jackie Brown soundtrack, and it plays when she's walking through Sybil Brandt, the women's prison in Los Angeles. And I love that, the layering of that meaning. This song from her youth and her past, when she was, you know, she was Pam Grier in all caps, with lyrics like "Look at me, you'll never be free," and we're hearing this voice of young Pam as we're seeing the older Pam Grier done up to look like she's been in a jail for 2 days. Her hair's a mess and she's older, and we hear this young Pam quite literally singing to this older Pam. I think it's just a wonderful, really clever moment in the film, and a nice callback to her Corman Jack Hill work in the Philippines.
Yeah, and that is a good movie. That's Big Birdcage, not Big Dollhouse. The names are real similar.
No, no, she was in the Big Dollhouse. That's what the Long Time Woman was from. And she was also in the Big Birdcage.
Yeah, but one's a sequel to the other one, but I forget what the order is.
I'm gonna out myself as a Roger Corman Jack Hill fan. It's the Big Dollhouse, and that was followed by the Big Birdcage.
Okay. And I love Black Mama, White Mama.
Yeah, yeah.
With I think Eddie Romero directed that, and Sid Haig plays a pretty evil pimp in that, and he's fucking phenomenal.
Yeah, he's great. I'd watch him. I'd watch him in any, almost anything.
Yeah. Side note: there's a weird subgenre. Like, ever, I think all the FLPM movies he's in with Pam, there's some reference to his character having a big dick in like all of them. And usually he fucks Pam in the movie at some point. It's just this kind of fun little running thing, but in her, like, in like Coffee and Foxy Brown, I think he plays villains who she kills. So it's a really interesting, like, the type of characters he would play depending on where the movies would take place.
And with his casting was a surprise on the day of filming. She did not know he was cast as the judge, and it was like a gift for, to her from Tarantino that she walked on set and there sat Sid Haig dressed as a judge.
Yeah, Sid shows up in Kill Bill Volume 2 as the bartender when Michael Madsen
right.
And like is going to talk to his boss, I think, when he gets fired.
You're right. I forgot that. He's like, bud, so-and-so would like to have a word.
I'm not super well-versed on Blaxploitation, and if you want to hear my full thoughts on Blaxploitation stuff in general, listen to our Cotton Comes to Harlem episode. We get into like a big discussion on this, like on the word itself and like the movies, and I have a lot of complex opinions on it, and I've already said my piece on them, and also download that episode because it's a really fun one. But like I don't know, like I feel like the Blaxploitation elements aren't that strong. I think there's some it's not like Kill Bill where it's like he's clearly like referencing, you know, like spaghetti westerns and like kung fu films, like Shaw Brothers films, and like Pinky Violence stuff. Like this is a more subtle, like a few moments here and there. It's just more so like a character like alt mini hangout movie.
Yeah, I never really viewed this as much a blaxploitation film as it is like a hangout film, or as you said, a heist movie. But I mean, I get it. You can't, if you're gonna have Pam in the opening seconds of your film, if you're gonna feature Pam Grier with Bobby Womack screaming across 110th Street,
which is the title track from the movie Across 110th Street.
Yeah, you do something like that, people are gonna immediately assume, oh, he's doing the blaxploitation thing. But I think it's less a blaxploitation film, and more like you said, there's little wisps and curly cues of blaxploitation kind of blown through the film. But what I like that Tarantino does in the film is it's more that he uses, get really pretentious here, he uses our kind of cultural knowledge of Pam Grier as this blaxploitation god, and our memory of her as this statuesque, all-powerful woman of rage and vengeance and justice in films like Coffee and Foxy Brown, and he uses that to contrast where Jackie Brown, the character, is in her life, where she's making $19,000 a year, $16,000 a year, in this ratty little Cabo Air flight attendant outfit, which Pam still makes look amazing, but that he's using our knowledge of Pam Grier at her best to show us how low this character is in her life by comparison. And so I think the blaxploitation stuff, I think, is a bit overhyped, and it's more about just using our knowledge of Pam as a blaxploitation star.
Yeah, I should clarify, I don't hate the movie. It's just my love for it is, I don't love it quite like I used to. And
you have an unusual way of rating things that just makes it look like, oh, Spencer hated this, where he's like, no, that's not what it was, you know.
It's just like after watching this again after like 6 years, which like 6 years ago was when I first discovered like Kurosawa, and that kind of like for me re-changed and really like calculated. Like, it reset my brain and, like, how I thought about film and looked at film. And I kind of became, like, Kurosawa crazy for a bit. And I think maybe that's why I stopped watching Tarantino over again, possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that might be why. Well, but that's like,
a good thing for you then, I mean.
Yeah, maybe. But like, just like watching this again, like I like the characters, I like the pace, I like everything. I don't like the heist part necessarily, because that's when I fell asleep this time.
That's the and once again, that is not a measure of whether a movie is good or bad, because yeah. I fell asleep during Solaris, and I would never say, "Oh, it's boring."
Yeah, like it's not like I said. Thing happened with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for me. Like, there's a point towards the like with the Rick Dalton stuff, I got a little tired of it. I almost fell asleep. I want to get back to hunky Brad Pitt with his shirt off on the roof.
That's when I found Spencer with his head on a box of popcorn.
Yeah,
you're breaking my heart right now.
Yeah, but I don't know. I feel like maybe if I watch this again 10 years from now, when I'm closer to Jackie's age and I'm older than Bridget Fonda's character.
Long after I'm dead. I don't think... You haven't watched it in 5 years, but I feel like it's a different experience than someone who...
watched this when I was 17, and I fell in love with it at 17. This is a weird one. Like, when I first saw it, it became my favorite Tarantino.
I don't like any of the movies I liked when I was 17. This is not good.
that's very surprising to me, though. Because, like I said, you know, when I saw this, because it wasn't Pulp Fiction 2, and again, I was an idiot, so, grain of salt there. But, yeah, I remember watching this at 15 and going, well, wait, this isn't... Where's the twisty-turny chronology? And where's all the violence and you know, the hyper-linguistics? And, you know, I couldn't understand that Tarantino had already made two films like that. And so that he had to kind of dial it back. I think he's a director who's very, maybe more so than a lot of others, and this probably comes from being such an obsessed film fan that he is, and also a video store clerk. You know, I think he's very aware of filmography as a curator. And I think, you know, he was looking at it, you know, what's John Cusack say in High Fidelity about the making of a great compilation tape? You know, you got to kick it off with a killer to grab everyone's attention, then you got to take it up a notch, which Tarantino did with Pulp Fiction. But then he's like, you don't want to blow your wad, so you got to cool it off a notch. There are a lot of rules. And I feel like Jackie Brown was his film where he's like, I can't go any further with Pulp Fiction, with the Reservoir Dogs Pulp Fiction aesthetic. I almost peaked. I've got to dial it back and pace myself and go in a different direction. And at the time, I wasn't ready for that. And that's why I was so chilly, or I received the film with such kind of a chill, because I wasn't able to understand why Tarantino would want to make a movie about
characters
rethinking their lives and not just shooting at each other for 2.5 hours. And now as I've gotten older, I've come to love it more and more with each year. So I think we're on opposite trajectories with our appreciation of the film.
Maybe, like, I like Tarantino as a cinephile, and I don't want to be like get like a Woody Allen surprise or something like that. That's why I want to be like, no, that's what I like his movies. As a person, like, when he's just kind of, sometimes in interviews he can be really obnoxious and irritating, and he dresses like Wu-Tang clothes and shit, and it's like, you're trying too hard, man. It seems a little much to me. It looks a little like you're. I feel like you're trying a little hard to be black right now, and it looks kind of weird.
That's what people say to me too.
But like, since it's Spike Lee podcast, we should probably bring up the issues Spike has had with Quentin. Which,
please tell me.
Yeah. Quentin was in Girl 6, the Prince movie. Well, Prince did a soundtrack to it. It's a Spike one that's forgotten, and I think it might be a bad one, because the Prince super fan we both know, Darren.
Yeah.
I asked him, do you want to cover Girl 6? He said, nope. He had no interest in watching it. So watching it again, I should say. Quentin is in Girl 6, and when Jackie Brown came out, he didn't like that. What's appropriate here? It feels weird being one black person here, but I'll say it. They use the word nigger, like, I think 38 times in the movie. And Spike didn't like that, and he said, it's only words. If I used a racial slur for Jewish people, it's just in a quote, I won't say what the word is. If I used a slur for Jewish people 38 times, my career would be dead, but Tarantino's allowed to say nigger 38 times, which, on one hand, I get where he's coming from, but on the other hand, it's like, Spike is also very reactionary to things. Like, I don't know, Travis, like, what are your thoughts on, like, on Spike's issue with this movie?
Well, as I understand it, his issue was cumulative, correct? It wasn't just this movie. It was Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction as well. And I feel like, I think if I recall correctly, this film was simply the breaking point. Now, that said, you know, I do find the usage of that word in Pulp Fiction to be unnecessary.
A little bit. It's off-putting.
It does just seem, you know, it does seem like it does not. I don't see the artistic purpose that it serves. If there is one, I don't see it. That said, I think my opinion on this should be taken with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. I felt like in the context of Jackie Brown, it was not as shocking or in your face or inappropriate. I felt it made sense for the characters in the milieu. I do feel like, I think the reason perhaps Spike reacted as strongly as he did when this film came out is it was more the cumulative effect of the three movies put together. And I do think he has, to some degree or another, he certainly has a right to be offended, and I certainly see his point of view as being one of, well, you know, I don't see what purpose this serves. I think that was the biggest thing. Spike was, I don't see the purpose of this. I don't see where the artistic necessity is for this.
Reservoir Dogs, I think you can justify it because Steve Buscemi's character is despicable and him being a racist makes sense.
Yeah.
And so, like, with that, it's fine because he only says it twice. I think maybe three times. And
it's
every time I watch it.
Just in that one scene where he's trying to break up a fight.
And every time I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot he's a racist in this movie.
Yeah.
But I still kind of like him, even though he's a racist. But, like, with Pulp Fiction, the dead nigger storage is just, like, real cringy. And it's, like, the one scene I always don't look forward to.
Yeah. And, again, I don't know if it's just to highlight the fact that all of the characters in this film are morally reprehensible. Of course, I don't really know that we need to be reminded of that, because Tarantino's character in Pulp Fiction is obviously fine with a dead man with a hole in his head being stored in his garage, so I don't think that we're already looking to him as to be a paragon of virtue or morality in the film. Yeah, I will say that it's never been something I've understood about Pulp Fiction, is why, what the necessity was. I also feel like, you know, I do feel like an artist should be free to write what they feel is necessary, but I can claim no understanding as to why that was necessary. But I do also think that Spike's attack of Jackie Brown, I don't particularly agree with.
I don't know, like, on one hand, like, when you go down the line to Django, a movie that I like, but just I find kind of questionable, a little bit, because it's whole, like, making a movie about slavery is it's a touchy, weird thing to tackle, because it's such a strong topic to talk about. and to make it like a spaghetti western, as like Spike said, like Spike basically said, my history is not a Sergio Leone spaghetti western. It's a Holocaust, which I agree. But also, I feel like Django, he's trying, like Tarantino was trying to maybe have us deal with slavery. But I don't think Tarantino is a guy I want to be the one who makes a movie about slavery.
Yeah.
It just feels like inappropriate.
That's understandable. Yeah. I go back and forth on Django to what you just said about, you know, bringing it to the cultural conversation, for lack of a better phrase. I don't know if Django is the film that needed to do that. I still enjoy the film a great deal, just like I enjoy Pulp Fiction a great deal. But as you said, yeah, I don't know if that's the film that we needed to discuss that topic. I believe he said in something, what did he say in his defense, Tarantino, when this went on with Spike? I have it here. He said, Tarantino said, I am working with the English language. I am not just a film director who shoots movies. I'm an artist, and good, bad, or indifferent, I'm coming from that place. All my choices, the way I live my life, are about that. And I think what he means by that is that, you know, essentially he's saying, I'm an artist, and an artist has to be free to write what they want to write. I can understand, though, the problems that people would have with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, especially. But as I said, whatever, I don't have that problem with Jackie Brown. And it might be because I don't believe a single white character uses the word as an epithet in Jackie Brown. I don't think it's ever used as an epithet.
That's right. I think it's just Chris Tucker and Jackson.
And Pam at one point. But I think it's because of Jackie, it's never used as a derogatory term or as a term to make someone less than. It's colloquial in Jackie Brown, and that's, I think, the difference for me.
And I don't know of Chris Tucker. It's the best use of Chris Tucker, because like he's a great, like, a MacGuffin for a plot, and
he's the golden briefcase.
Yeah.
If you play his part in this movie at the same time as you play his part in The Fifth Element, a black hole will be created.
This is a perfect role because he gets killed 10 minutes in, and it's like, oh great, don't have to deal with him anymore. Except I like him on Friday and this, and that's kind of it. I find his shtick to be grating after a certain point.
But he is great in this film. He has a great shot of him near the beginning of this film. He's perfect. He's absolutely perfect.
Yeah, now he would never do a role like this because he... not shaming him, but he's a born-again Christian. That's his choice. And he won't do movies anymore where he has to swear.
Like
he will never do like another comedy like Friday ever again.
There goes his role in the Jackie Brown prequel.
Yeah.
And, you know, speaking of just great shots of life in this film, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up really quickly. I feel like when a lot of people talk about Jackie Brown and they talk about the performances in Jackie Brown, they mention De Niro as almost a disappointment, or, boy, he sure was reserved in that movie. You know, he didn't get a big scene to chew on. I just want to say I love Robert De Niro in this movie, and I think Robert De Niro might be my favorite thing about this film.
Yeah, this watch through, I was like, this watch, I was like, holy shit, I never noticed how good he was in this movie. Like, I just love, like, he's very quiet and reserved, and like, you just know that explosion is going to happen at some point. And like, this time, like one of the few surprises was like, oh, I didn't even realize, like, it's like it's a time bomb with De Niro. You just know he's just way too chill, and at some point he's going to snap, and you don't know who it will be at.
Right. Also, when his character is anytime with Ordell around, like, he cannot get a word in edgewise if you really wanted to. And so it makes more sense that when Ordell is not around, that's when he starts, loses his cool.
Yeah, although there's the one scene where Ordell lets him talk where he's like, so she fucked you? And he's like, yeah, I thought she was your girlfriend. He's like, but you still fucked her, right? And it's this really great, I like how he will play with the power in each situation. Like when he first sees Max, he's like, so you suggested you guys take this picture? Is he your employee? And so this great little, he can immediately read people. And Max clearly knows what's going on and does not give a shit. And just is very professional and is like, okay, let's move on. I don't have time for your games right now.
Just have to mention really quick when you meant that scene where they're in the bar and Ordell says, but you fucked it, didn't you? And I hope you felt appropriately guilty after. I love De Niro's little afterwards I did, and that little smile he gives as he stirs his drink. But yeah, God, what I love about De Niro in this movie is he originally went for the role of Max Cherry. He wanted the role of Max, and Tarantino was like, I'm sorry, I already have someone else kind of in mind for that, because he really wanted Robert Forster. And so I think that De Niro took the role essentially because, in 1995, 96, when this movie's being made, everyone wanted to be in the next Tarantino film. So I think he took Lewis because, he wanted to be a part of the film, and Tarantino wasn't going to give him Max. And yet, I feel like that De Niro, for one of the first times in a long time in this film, he was kind of free of the leading man responsibilities. And so he's able to just really lean back with this kind of low-key engine idling performance, where, like you said, he's just hanging back. It being De Niro, something is going to happen. There is going to be an emotional explosion of some sort. But I really love how much he captures just this perpetually flummoxed and resigned vibe. He was like this once sharp blade that's now just dulled from overuse. He's graying and overweight, and he's got these blousy and rumpled bowling shirts that can't hide all the prison ink on his arms that track all of the lost years of his youth to prison. And what kills me about his character is he's kind of the walking, talking embodiment of everything that all the other characters in this film are terrified of becoming.
Oh, yeah.
He's the guy, all these other characters, they're worried that time has begun to pass them by. They're not.
Early on, there's they mentioned something about some sort of technology, something with technology or movies. And he's like, huh, I never heard of that. I forgot what, but there's just some quick reference where it's like he's just not up to speed.
When he wants to go wait in Ordell's car and he can't figure out the key fob to unlock the car, and Ordell has to explain to him how many times you have to click the button, how many beeps you have to wait for, and yet Lewis just stares at it like it's a laser gun. He has no idea how to use this thing. And he's like this both like prison hardened but also like prison softened. I don't know, he's like a Dickensian ghost of of like wasted Christmas past and hopeless Christmas future. And yeah, he's like the thing that all of these characters are afraid they're going to become if they don't make some kind of move and make some kind of final score, because Lewis is already done. And that's what's so tragic about his character, is I don't think it matters what cut of this score he receives. He's fucked for life. Lewis is done. He's cashed in.
Yeah. We haven't talked about the two cops that much. Ray Nicolette, played by Michael Keaton, and the other guy, played by Michael Bowen. And this time I paid more attention to Michael Bowen's character, and I just like him being like this kind of shitty cop, where Keaton is a little more human, but Bowen is more he's a bad cop in this scenario, but I just love his kind of him being an asshole in every scenario.
Cut to 13 years later, and you're 44 years of age, flying for the shittiest little shuttle fucking piece of shit Mexican airline there is, you make $13,000 a year? And let's see, you've been in the service industry 16 years, and you only make $13,000 a year plus benefits? Didn't set the world on fire, did you, Jackie? That might be my favorite line in the movie. Didn't set the world on fire, did you, Jackie?
Yeah, and it's like, I feel like he's underused. Like, I would have liked more stuff with the cops.
And I would have too. There's a little bit more, or there's actually a lot more in Rum Punch. But there are far more utility players in the movie.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, why, again, I think at this point, a post-Pulp Fiction, Tarantino could get anyone he wanted. I think one of the reasons why you get Michael Keaton as Ray Nicolette is you need someone to... You need a recognizable and kind of edgy actor to bring some kind of live wire electricity to this character, who I think on the page, there's not a lot there.
No.
And I think that's why the casting of these two is so important, is you need people that are going to bring an edge to these characters who are somewhat plot devices on the page.
Yeah. Keaton-wise, like, wasn't his career kind of not great at this point in 97? Because, like, Batman Returns kind of didn't do so well, and like, what was Jack Frost this time?
Well, I think that was a couple of years later. I think this was he'd done The Paper, he had done Multiplicity at this point, the year before. I think he'd done Multiplicity. And I think that after he turned down Batman Forever in 95, I think, yeah, this was kind of in his 90s journeyman period.
Yeah, Jack Frost was the year after, yeah.
Oh, that's disappointing. And Michael Bowen, I don't think P.T. Anderson had taken off yet. And Bowen, isn't he in the porn one? And he's in the frog one, where, like, he's the dad of the kid who pees.
Yes, he's in Magnolia. He's that's right. He's the abusive father to the genius child on What the Kids Know, or whatever the show is called.
I think he's in some other P.T. Anderson stuff too, but I don't think Bowen had really it happened yet either.
No, Bowen, not from what I've seen here. It doesn't look like he's in any other P.T.
Oh,
but he was in The Godfather 3.
Great. And I've avoided Godfather 3 for years.
You like The Player, right? You like Robert Altman.
I haven't gone past the 80s yet. I'm still working through his expansive 70s and 60s stuff, which there's a whole lot of.
But yeah, I believe Tarantino was a big fan of his from Valley Girl.
Oh.
Valley Girl, okay. So, and that's where he met Nicolas Cage and they started working. No, wait.
Friend of the show, I almost said her real name, Bo North, on her other podcast, the non-Dune one, they did a Shakespeare series of modern-day Shakespeare adaptations, and they did Valley Girl, because that's, I think, Romeo and Juliet.
I thought you were going to say...
So, Joel, do you have any thoughts on, like, Tarantino and race and stuff like that?
Well, I think that most white people should shut up about that in general. So, it's... Yeah, I mean...
it's a weird thing.
Spike Lee has a short fuse for and stuff like that. That's true. But he's also completely right. And that answer that Tarantino gave to the, you know, I'm an artist and that stuff like that, that just strikes me as a lot of, you can't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Which is not, it's like, yeah, that's, I mean, when you're a white male, you don't want people telling you what to do. I get it. No offense to our guest and everyone else.
I mean, Joel, both you and I are mixed white and other races, so I think it applies to us a little bit too.
I mean, it applies to me all day long, because I even though I am half Mexican, I don't look Mexican, so yeah.
I get mistaken for Mexican all the time.
That's why I don't write any scripts where people are using the N-word in general.
It's yeah. And I didn't we didn't really talk about Hateful Eight, which I only saw the one time in the theater. This was like a super fun experience where it was like me and my dad loves Tarantino movies too. And it was the first time we got to see one together in a theater.
Yeah, cool.
And we drove like 2 hours to the nearest theater that did the road show.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a super fun experience just to watch it with my dad in a packed crowd.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I haven't seen it since then. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Like, I don't know how I'd feel about the racial stuff in it now. Like, not being in a theater and being like, and having this family trip thing.
Yeah, I have to think about that. I should rewatch it.
Yeah.
It's a film I adore.
Oh, yeah. It's like my number 3, probably.
Yeah, that's like another one. Not as I think it is as incendiary as Django, just in different ways. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of another example of like, I don't know if Tarantino is the guy I want like tackling this type of story necessarily.
Yeah.
I do feel like Hateful Eight is a film that has become more meaningful, unfortunately. In the last 2 or 3 years in America, I think that there's a lot in that film that not a lot of other, white mainstream directors were putting into their films. You know, there's so many moments, like when Sam Jackson, when he was saying, when there's a line where his character says, when black people are scared, that's when white people feel safe. And sentiments like that, those were, even 2 or 3 years ago, felt so much more incendiary than they do now. And now they just feel so much more apt for the America that we're in right now.
I don't know. Like, growing up a minority, some of this stuff was like, yeah, no shit. I have experienced some form of this in my life. And Joel, I'm sure the same for you to some extent too.
I did not fight in the Civil War. also, I would never shoot Channing Tatum in the head. Oh, spoiler! Sorry.
I'd never shoot Bruce Dern. He's an American treasure.
I might shoot him. Just in the leg. Just so I can hear him go like, God damn it, what is wrong with you? I thought you wanted an autograph.
We're watching TV.
There's nothing better than Cranky Bruce Dern. There's absolutely nothing better.
Yeah, I love his scene in Once Upon a Time, where he's like, where do we watch TV every Sunday?
Squeaky was right for me, so.
Nothing made me laugh harder in that film than when he briefly becomes compassionate and he looks at Brad Pitt and he's like, but you touched me. You came here to check on me. You touched me today.
I didn't recognize Dakota Fanning as Squeaky at all. I knew that was her, but I was thinking that can't be her. Mm. It can't be Dakota Fanning. And it kind of feels like she's trying to catch up with her cooler, younger sister. But I don't know if she ever will.
Maybe I'm one of the few only people that like that one show. She was like on a miniseries that takes place.
Oh, the Alienist.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I thought she was really good in that.
Yeah, I'm going to catch up on that. But Elle was in Neon Demon, which I dearly love.
Elf.
Yeah. She's the reason I went to see the remake of that Clint Eastwood movie. What the fuck is it called? The Sofia Coppola movie that a lot of people don't like, but I...
The Beguiled.
Beguiled, yeah.
Yeah. Spoiler for an upcoming Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space episode, but we watched How to Talk to Girls at Parties, I think it's called. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the Neil Gaiman?
Yes, the one adapted from his story. And the movie's okay, but she is awesome in it.
And hey, watch Real Language. I think Justin Harrison loves that movie. I know.
Hey, if you like latex-wearing aliens, it's a great movie.
Yeah. Like, that's thing about getting back to Jackie Brown. There's touches on some racial stuff with, like, Jackie being a middle-aged black woman and, like, her realizing that opportunities are running short, and she's also a black woman, so that makes it even harder. And then there are little moments where when Ordell was with Max and he's like, oh, you're probably thinking, how does this guy have so much money? And it's just kind of funny moment of like he's just trying to fuck with him slash like see where he stands. And I love that. I think the second time I meet Max does actually say, well, you're probably a drug dealer and blah blah, and just kind of runs it down, and it's almost perfectly accurate.
Yeah, he's like, at first I'd say, now you want me to guess what you do for a living. At first I'd say drugs, but the money's moving in the wrong direction. It's like, whatever you're doing, you must be good at it, so more power to you. Like, I love that he won't even, like, even when he plays with Ordell, he's making it in the most no bullshit terms possible. Like, I get what you're doing, I get what you're trying to do with me. Let's just move on.
And I think there's a point where Ordell's talking to him, and he's like, yeah, that's my house. I own a home.
Oh, yeah, he's like, is that an apartment or a house? That'd be a house.
And he says it with such flair, and it's this great little moment, and it's like, Ordell is not, like, in that moment, like, Ordell's happy to be, like, a black man who owns property in L.A., which I guess L.A., from what I hear, is a bit expensive.
Jesus, I wouldn't know. Christ. Yeah. Yeah, it's a nightmare. That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah. One tiny thing. There's a shot of them drinking coffee, Max and Jackie drinking coffee, that looks like Sarah Jacobson did a similar thing in Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore, where she's on a date with Ryan, the guy with the smiley faces on everything.
Yeah.
Have you seen that movie, Travis?
No, I haven't.
It's on YouTube. I think there's a DVD out there somewhere, but it's a really good indie movie from the late 90s. And Sarah Jacobson never made another movie again. And then she died of, I think, breast cancer.
Because she died of breast cancer.
Well, also, she never got opportunities after this movie. But there's a shot that looks identical. And Mary Jane's not...
Is it just that static shot of them sitting against the wall? I just sat at the table. Yeah, I love the simplicity of that.
Let's see. I remember another thing I noticed, like, with her, Jackie smoking, the first time in the office, she's not allowed to, and the police officers, she's not allowed to smoke. And the second time, she is allowed to smoke, and she's a lot more confident when she can smoke. And the third time, when Ray Nicolette is like, well, whatever you're going to do from now on, I hope you don't fuck up, because you could, you know, you're free. And you see the cigarette ash is like, is ridiculous, and she needs to, like, you know, get rid of it. And it's like, this is a very simple, it's like in The Shining where Shelley, there's a shot of, like, the cigarette ash. It's a super long on the cigarette at one point. And, like, it's this very simple thing. And where Jackie, like, with her smoking in the police officer's place, like, it looks like it's a visual symbol of how comfortable she is.
Yeah, exactly. It's a nice little arc to her, or it's a nice little kind of metric of her arc in the film, that first time where she has no power in the office when she's trying to smoke, and he says to her, like, I don't believe I heard you ask permission to smoke in my office. No, you cannot. And then, the second time when she's giving them everything on Ordell they want, she's like, may I smoke? He's like, yes, of course. But I love that last one, though, when she still has all the power, and she has succeeded, at least in the heist part of her plan. But I love it in that scene with that long bit of ash, she's also holding back tears because she still hasn't solved the Ordell part of her problem. And she has all the power, but now there's this... Now she has to be responsible for having taken that power, and she's sitting there you know, wondering what the fuck have I done, and am I going to get out of this? Like, am I going to I might have beaten the police, but I haven't beaten Nordell yet. And I love that kind of fear and lack of solid ground beneath her feet in that moment, and just a great bit of nonverbal acting from her.
Yeah. And all right, Joel, you got any last words on Jackie Brown?
No, not really. I mean, I love this movie the same way I love the random heist movies that I'm into. It, like, as what I'm saying in general, I feel like it's a good movie.
Yeah.
I feel like the Quentin Tarantino touches are still somehow endearing to me. But they also, if you compare this to the notes of what you expect in a Quentin Tarantino movie, like if you have, like, say, the bingo card or something, I think there's only a couple of things you can really cross off, one of them unfortunately being feet.
yeah, with toe rings, which I guess were a thing in the 90s.
I mean, wait, does he have toe rings all over the other movies?
No, in this movie, like, the first shot of, like, Bridget Fonda, like, is just her legs and her feet.
Yeah, I just don't...
And also, let's just say really quick, what a great performance she gives.
Oh, yeah.
She's amazing in this film. Yeah, I don't mean to step over everybody, but yeah, I love how awful she is as a character.
No.
How good she is at portraying that awfulness.
Yeah. Didn't she retire pretty soon after this? Because didn't she I think she married, like, Danny Elfman or someone.
She did, and yeah, I believe she retired in the early 2000s, 2001, 2002.
She retired and married Danny Elfman, is that what you said?
Yeah.
She married someone famous, and I think she has a bunch of kids with the person. And
I see.
And I hope she's doing well, because I think Peter was her dad. It's craft-wise, it's really, you know, well done. Tarantino's no slop. No slop, Jesus Christ. Yeah, Tarantino knows what he's doing, just... I don't know, like, maybe... I need to... Maybe 5 years from now, I'll like Tarantino like I used to. Or maybe not, I don't know.
Yeah. I think a couple years down the line might be the proper time to reevaluate again.
Yeah. I should revisit Hateful Eight and Django. I just don't know if I... Anyway, do you guys want to, like, generally talk about Once Upon a Time, or would that take too much?
Right. I would just say it's a great film. I'm gonna whore it and just say it's a great film. If you haven't seen it, anyone out there listening, you should see it.
Yeah, it's a good cinema experience. Although my audience was kind of shitty. Where I live, it's not a... Like, where I live, when I saw Midsommar, one person kind of ruined it because they were laughing at all the wrong parts. Like, for the last hour of the movie. And it's 2.5 hours, so it kind of ruined the experience a little bit.
Yeah, it sucks.
And that's a movie I really liked. It's just... I don't have the time or money to see movies that often. I don't like to drive. So kind of like, this is my special night out, and this person kind of was real shitty. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, the audience, when I saw Once Upon a Time, was, like, they didn't laugh at anything.
Oh my God.
Like, it was just a strange experience. Overall, I liked it, but I don't feel like driving, because I'm poor, and that means I have to, but yeah, I would recommend see it. Like, it's... I'm pretty sure it's still playing. It's making a lot of money.
Yeah, and I would argue, I think it's his masterpiece.
And, Travis, you have other 1997 movies?
Yeah, throw on a couple. If I was programming a double feature, and I didn't want to go with the more obvious Jackie Brown Out of Sight double feature, because Out of Sight came out in 98, if I was doing a double feature with Jackie Brown, I think the second film on the bill would be this 1997 flick, which is James Mangold's Copland.
Oh, it's Stallone.
Yeah, and also De Niro. De Niro was actually wearing the same mustache from this film. And it's another film that's about characters looking at a character, well, in this case, mainly a character, Stallone's character, playing a small-town sheriff who, like a lot of the characters in Jackie Brown, is getting a little older, he's getting softer, and he's looking at his life, and he doesn't like what he sees. And he realizes a lot of his time has been wasted. And he is looking for a way to make a choice of consequence and meaning that will give consequence and meaning to his life. And I feel like it's a really, in addition to being a great crime film, just like Jackie Brown, I think that thematically they're really well connected. And if I could program a double feature at a theater with Jackie Brown, it would definitely be Copland. And they're both from the same year. And it's a really great, really underrated film. And a lot like Jackie Brown, people kind of ignored it when it came out because it was a Miramax movie, it was a crime movie, so it was another film that audiences were kind of expecting to be a Pulp Fiction 2 situation, especially with that incredible cast of Ray Liotta, Sylvester Stallone, Robert De Niro, Robert Patrick, Harvey Keitel, and instead, like Jackie Brown, it was a more quiet, kind of ruminative film. But they go really well together, and it's one of my all-time favorites from 97.
Now, fun fact about Robert Patrick, my girlfriend's brother's partner works as like a college recruiter, and Robert Patrick was like one of his clients, and he got to hang out with Robert Patrick for like a bit in LA to like help recruit his son or daughter to go to I think Sarah Lawrence is one of the colleges up there. And according to him, Robert Patrick is a pretty cool dude.
Yeah, I've seen him. I've seen him at the at events and things. He's a really nice guy.
I'm fine with him. I just wish he would stop chasing after my car like that.
his cameo in Wayne's World confused me for a long time before I saw Terminator 2. Like, it made no sense to me first few times I saw Wayne's World. Then, like, I saw Terminator 2, like, oh, okay. That's, like, a very specific reference that...
Did you ever get the Laverne and Shirley reference?
Yeah, I knew Laverne and Shirley.
I'm just checking. Just checking.
I got their Delaware reference.
Other 97 flick I would throw out there, and this is like my dictionary definition of like the perfect 3-star out of 4-star movie. Breakdown, Kurt Russell. Mm. Anyone remember that? Breakdown. Mm-hmm. Oh no,
it's Joel. It's Breakdown. You're older than me.
No, I've never seen it before.
Oh my god, it's so good. It's a great, just like really great workmanlike bit of craftsmanship. It's just a great 3-star thriller. It's no frills. It's not high art, but it is just perfect, pure entertainment. Kurt Russell and Kathleen Quinlan play a married couple. They're driving cross country. His wife, Quinlan, gets kidnapped by a nefarious truck driver, and no one will believe Kurt Russell. And he essentially spends the whole movie running and sweating and screaming across the American Southwest trying to find his wife. And it's just a really perfect crackerjack thriller. And I highly, highly recommend it. Breakdown. Directed by Jonathan Mostow, I think. It's really great.
Okay, I have one very brief one that I didn't bring up before. It's a little movie called The Eel by Shoha Imamura. It's his, I think, third to last film.
That win Palme d'Or that year?
Yes, it did. And it's Imamura trying to like make a movie about like the goodness of humanity, which if you see his movies, that's a strange thing for him to make a movie about. And it's kind of like him kind of not, it's not as nightmarish as his other movies can get, but still gets deeply upsetting because it's Imamura, he can't not do that. But it's kind of like him trying to do like something a little more uplifting. And, it's really, really good.
I'm just going to spit out The Game by Fincher and Lost Highway by David Lynch.
Those were recommended by the other guest on the other 97 episode.
I haven't listened to it yet. I'm a horrible person, I know, but I got to throw those two out there.
It's on Ease Value, which is 27, which is a great movie.
It is.
And Joel, Do you want to go through your other podcast, 97 movies again, or not really?
I tell you, one of the 1997 movies that we've covered that I'm sure is popular with everybody and everybody knows about, it's a movie called The Midas Touch, where a kid gets the Midas Touch. Things start to turn to gold. He starts to turn gold. There's some wacky things. It kind of feels like it's a kids' rules movie, you know, like, yeah, those adults, they can't stop us. We cover a lot of 97, A Lifeless Ordinary, I go into that one again, Anastasia, what is the name of that animator?
Don Bluth. Don Bluth,
yeah.
He's your enemy. Movie,
which is okay. Fifth Element, Gattaca, Event Horizon. Hey, Fifth Element came out the same year as Jackie Brown. Man, that was a Chris Tucker year.
Yeah.
Anyways, if you are interested in hearing me talk about some of that stuff, you can listen to Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, Science Fiction and Fantasy Movie Podcast.
All right. And Travis, I believe you are a writer and editor as well?
Yeah, I'm writer-editor for Right Wall Dark Room. Really, really great site, a lot of great cinematic deep dive writing. And I'm going to be hosting my own podcast soon, produced by Blake Howard, who did the One Heat Minute podcast, breaking down every single minute of Michael Mann's Heat, one episode at a time, and climax that with an interview with Mann himself. And I'm going to be taking a similar but different approach. We're doing a podcast called Increment Vice, which is going to break down Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice one scene at a time with various guests who include writers and critics and fans of the film, as well as cast and crew from the film itself. Yeah. And it's going to be really weird, really strange, and I have no idea if anyone will like it, but I'm looking forward to it.
Are you going to try to get the author of the book?
Yeah, that might be a difficult get. That might be a little tough. But hey, The Simpsons got them, so maybe we will.
In the first season, the Kershaw season, we had Lauren Wilford and Ryan Stevenson on a couple times from... Yeah, that's it. Travis, you'll be back for Black Klansman at the end of this year.
I guess I will.
I think that's the last episode for 2019. Oh, wait, no, we have a special episode. That's the last normal episode for the year, I believe. So, you'll be coming back pretty soon. And Joel, I think after I drop this, it will be the class, the Cannes winner from 2008. Uh-huh. I don't feel good about the episode because I feel like I sounded dumb on that one. But whatever, that'll come out. And then I think around that time will be the 25th Hour one too with Darren. So Darren Husted from the various Minute by Minute podcast, the Boy Next Door. I was on like three of them. I forgot what they are. Boy Next Door,
As If, and Talking Cast.
Yeah, and Prince Track by Track, which I was on like 10 times maybe. And that's it. Thank you, Travis.
Thank you for having me. I had a lot of fun.
And we'll see you guys next time for the class or 25th Hour. I'm not sure yet.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.